22. At the end of March, the Nazis felt strong enough to initiate the first act of their real revolution, a revolution not against some constitution or other, but against the basis of human society on Earth, a revolution that, if nothing is done, will stop at nothing. The first diffident move was the boycott of the Jews on April 1, 1933. It had been thought up by Hitler and Goebbels over tea and biscuits at Obersalzberg in Bavaria the Sunday before. On Monday, the papers carried the peculiarly ironic headline, "Mass Demonstrations Announced." From Saturday, April 1st, they said, all Jewish shops would be boycotted. SA troops would stand guard in front of them and prevent anyone from going in. All Jewish doctors and lawyers were also to be boycotted. SA patrols would check their consulting rooms to ensure that the ruling was obeyed. One could see the advances that the Nazis had made in just 1 month by considering the justification for the boycott. The myth of a communist coup that had been used to override the Constitution and remove civil liberties had been carefully and plausibly constructed. They'd even felt the need to supply some direct evidence in the form of the Reichstag fire. The justification for this new affront was a bare-faced insult and mockery of those who were expected to act as though they believed it. The boycott was to be carried out as a defense and reaction against the totally unfounded horror stories about the new Germany that the German Jews were alleged to have cleverly spread abroad. Yes, just so. Further measures were added in the next few days, some of them later temporarily rescinded. All Aryan shops had to sack their Jewish employees. Then all Jewish shops had to do so too. Jewish shops had to pay their Aryan employees in full during the period they were closed by the boycott. Jewish owners had to withdraw from their businesses and install Aryan managers, and so on. At the same time, a great education campaign against the Jews was set in motion. The Germans were informed through pamphlets, posters, and meetings that it had been a mistake to consider the Jews as human beings. In reality, they were a kind of subhuman animal, but with the characteristics of a devil. The consequences that would be drawn from this were not spelled out for the moment. Still, the campaign slogan was given out as Juda Vereke, Perish Judah. A man who had hitherto been unknown to most Germans was appointed as leader of the boycott, Julius Streicher. All this aroused in the German people something one might not have expected after the previous 4 weeks, widespread alarm. A murmur of dissent, suppressed but audible, spread through the land. The Nazis sensed that they had gone too far for the moment and withdrew some of their measures after April 1st. Not, however, without first allowing these to unleash the full force of their terror. By now everyone knows to what extent the Nazis have changed their true intentions. Apart from the terror, the unsettling and depressing aspect of this first murderous declaration of intent was that it triggered a flood of arguments and discussions all over Germany, not about anti-Semitism, but about the Jewish question. This is a trick the Nazis have since successfully repeated many times on other questions and in international affairs. By publicly threatening a person, an ethnic group, a nation, or a region with death and destruction, they provoke a general discussion not about their own existence, but about the right of their victims to exist. In this way, that right is put in question. Suddenly everyone felt justified, and indeed required, to have an opinion about the Jews and to state it publicly. Distinctions were made between decent Jews and the others. If some pointed to the achievements of Jewish scientists, artists, and doctors to justify the Jews, justify? What for? Against what? Others would counter that they were a detrimental foreign influence in these spheres. Indeed, it soon became customary to count it against the Jews if they had a respectable or intellectually valuable profession. This was treated as a crime, or at the very least a lack of tact. The defenders of the Jews were frowningly told that it was reprehensible of the Jews to have such and such a percentage of doctors, lawyers, journalists, etc. Indeed, percentage calculations were a popular ingredient of the Jewish question. People discussed whether the percentage of Jews among the members of the Communist Party was not too high, and among the casualties of the Great War perhaps too low. This is the literal truth. I heard this argument in the mouth of an educated man with a PhD, who reckoned himself a member of the cultured class. He argued quite seriously that the 12,000 Jewish dead in the Great War was too small a proportion of the Jewish population in comparison with the corresponding number of Aryans killed, and derived from this a certain justification for Nazi antisemitism. Today it is quite clear that Nazi antisemitism had nothing to do with the virtues or vices of the Jews. The interesting thing about the Nazis' intention to train the Germans to be persecutors of the Jews throughout the world, and if possible exterminate them, an intention they made no secret of, is not the justification they gave. That is such utter nonsense that it is demeaning even to take it seriously enough to argue against it. It is the intention itself that is significant. It is something new in the history of the world, an attempt to deny humans the solidarity of every species that enables it to survive, to turn human predatory instincts that are normally directed against other animals, against members of their own species, and to make a whole nation into a pack of hunting hounds. Once the violence and readiness to kill that lies beneath the surface of human nature has been awakened and turned against other humans, and even made into a duty, it is a simple matter to change the target. That can be clearly seen today. Instead of Jews, one can just as easily say Czechs, or Poles, or anyone else. We have here the systematic infection of a whole nation, Germany, with a germ that causes its people to treat their victims like wolves, or to put it differently, the freeing and revitalization of precisely those sadistic instincts whose chaining and restraint has been the work of 1,000 years of civilization. In a later chapter, I intend to show how, in spite of its general weakness and dishonor, large parts of the German nation still find the strength to resist, perhaps from a dark feeling for what is at issue. Were it different, and should the central core of the Nazis' program become a reality, it would amount to a major crisis for humanity, and would place the survival of the species Homo sapiens at risk. It might only be possible to save the species by destroying the part infected by the wolf virus completely. This brief discourse shows that it is precisely the Nazis' anti-Semitism that raises the most basic questions of existence, not just for the Jews. That is not true to the same extent of any of their other election pledges. It shows how ridiculous the attitude is, still found widely in Germany, that the anti-Semitism of the Nazis is a small side issue, at worst a minor blemish on the movement, which one can regret or accept according to one's personal feelings for the Jews, and of little significance compared to the great national issues. In reality, these great national issues are unimportant day-to-day matters, the ephemeral business of a transitional period in European history. While the Nazis' anti-Semitism is a fundamental danger and raises the spectre of the downfall of humanity. Again, these are all things that nobody saw with any clarity in March 1933. In this case, however, I can pride myself in having had a sense of what was in the air. I felt distinctly that what had happened so far was merely disgusting and no more, but what was in the offing had something apocalyptic about it. In rarely visited corners of my mind, I felt that we were facing ultimate questions, though I did not yet know quite what they were. At the same time, coupled with the feeling of dread, I had an almost joyful sense that events were closing in on me. I am what the Nazis call an Aryan. Of course, I know as little as anyone else which races go to make up my genetic heritage. But Jewish blood has not been in the family during the 200 or 300 years that it can be traced. Nevertheless, I feel a stronger, instinctive affinity to the world of the German Jews than to the ordinary northern Germans among whom I grew up. My relationships with Jews go back a long way, and have been very close. My oldest and closest friend was Jewish. My new little girlfriend Charlie was Jewish. I had really not taken this affair very seriously, but now that the hand of doom was reaching for her, I felt that I loved her a little more fiercely and passionately. I phoned her on the evening of the day of the first announcements in the papers. That week I saw her almost every day, and our relationship began to take on the shape of a true love affair. Of course, in everyday life, Charlie was not a little Turkish page boy, as she had been at the ball. She was a girl from a lower middle-class family, with a confusing background and with many relatives. But she was a small, fragile, friendly person, and calamity threatened her. During these weeks, I truly loved her. I remember a bizarre scene with Charlie in that last week of March, amid the distant thunder of the approaching boycott. We had gone for a walk in the Grunewald, the woods to the west of Berlin. It was beautiful, unusually warm spring weather, as it had been throughout that March. We sat on the grass among the fir trees, inhaling the scent of resin under an indescribably clear sky with little clouds, like a couple in a film. The world was full of the peace of springtime. We sat there for about 2 hours, and every 10 minutes or so, a group of young people would go past. It seemed to be a day for school outings. They were all fresh-faced adolescents, accompanied and supervised by their teachers, who often wore a pince-nez or a little beard, as one expects of a teacher faithfully watching over his little flock. Every one of these classes, as they passed, shouted, "Jude Verke!" to us in their bright young voices, as though it was a sort of hiker's greeting. It may not have been aimed at us in particular. I do not look at all Jewish, and Charlie did not look very Jewish either. Perhaps it was just a friendly greeting. Perhaps, though, it was intended for us, and was a challenge. So there I sat, on the springtime hill, with a small, graceful, vivacious girl in my arms. We kissed and caressed each other, and every so often a group of boys went past and cheerfully told us to perish. Well, we did not oblige, and they went on their way, unconcerned by our failure to comply. A surreal image.